for him. In reality, she works for one of the regents of the Federation.
Regent? Faye asked.
Several smaller nations make up the Federation, forming a single larger country, and each of these smaller nations, called provinces, is ruled by a regent, Nathan explained. They use a wide variety of titles, including king of all things, but they're collectively referred to as the regents of the Amica Federation.
And Seraph works for one of these regents, but never told me who,
Sunstorm said. Nathan had a fairly good idea who it was. He knew who was responsible for the war with the Empire in the first place, but he remained silent. Openly stating the name would raise suspicion from Anna and Vera for little gain.
If we're only facing one champion, then this is done and dusted, right?
Anna suggested.
Nathan let out a bark of laughter. I wish. Sunstorm says Seraph is a highly experienced duo-gem champion. I have two mono-gem champions, a spellblade equal to a mono-gem champion, and a sorceress who can perhaps match a mono-gem with the help of her cairn.
I don't follow, Anna replied, giving him a quizzical look. You have four champions. They have won.
Even if we beat her, which is far from guaranteed, she'll likely kill one or more of us, Nathan said flatly. Each gem provides an exponential increase in power. That's why tri-gem champions are legends. A single one can demolish lesser bastions and several duo-gem champions.
The room fell silent. Sunstorm stepped back from the table with a grimace.
Time for a break, Nathan thought. He shooed everybody into a separate room and had some of the newly hired staff bring up lunch. Small talk was had over spiced sausages, potatoes, and bread. A simple meal, but nice enough. Nathan spent part of it fighting off Faye's wandering hands. She kept trying to eat his food. After he stopped her from cleaning his plate, she then tried to clean a certain other part of his body. He stopped her from doing that, too, much to her annoyance and the relief of the other women in the room.
So, do you have a plan?
Anna asked him once the plates were taken away. Leopold finally responded over the wireless, Nathan said.
And?
He's coming here. Nathan frowned. Whatever plan I come up with will depend on his support. I don't know what happened at Forzel Valley, or whether Leopold will order me to hold the pass instead.
Anna huffed. But what do you want to do?
Nathan smirked. What do you think I want to do?
Given how you've acted since you got here?
Anna walked her fingers across the table.
Go on the offensive. You talk up Seraph and how dangerous she is, but you've said that about everything. I know you have a plan. What you're looking for is an excuse to put it into action.
And do you want me to do that? Nathan asked. You are my countess.
Let's say that I'm looking forward to ruling both sides of Garrick Pass.
Chapter 32. Seraph drummed her fingers on her desk. The old men droned on and on, their voices projected over the wireless. Her patience had long since worn thin, but she was nothing if not professional. Snapping at her employers and her current bastion did her no favors, so she muted herself, poured a glass of wine, and stared at the wall of her office. Nobody else was here. The lights of her office were off. Only moonlight kept her company.
Fias, tell us again how many champions you encountered at Forzel Valley?
One of the old men asked, his voice reedy over the wireless projection. This was Grand Meister Corvel, the regent of a city-state within the Federation.
At least a dozen, Fias said.
Seraph resisted the urge to burst into laughter. The old men bickered amongst themselves again. Only one of the three didn't believe Fias.
Pray tell, Fias, where the Empire could get a dozen champions given their current situation,
the disbeliever asked. He was King George II, whose family split from the Empire a century ago.
Garrick Pass had originally been part of George's territory when his family had seceded from the Empire and created their own kingdom. That had lasted for about a decade before the Empire reclaimed everything west of the Garrick Mountains. But George pretended he owned the pass anyway. These days, his power had faded so much that he had joined the Federation and was a king in name only. Why the Federation let him call himself a king was beyond Seraph. Corvell had been the head of a merchant guild that ran a city-state from the shadows. George was a noble who could trace his bloodline to the archdukes that ruled the Anfeng Empire in the time that the Watcher Omria walked Domar. The two held the same status in this meeting, as both were regents. The last member of this triumvirate of grumbling old men finally intervened.
"Now, George, we all know that our intelligence on the Empire's military resources has been unreliable at times," the last crafty old bastard said, his arrogance oozing through the wireless.
Seraph grimaced at the magical device.
"High Lord Tanius, Seraph's long-term sponsor and the regent of one of the founding states of the Amica Federation." The stories behind how he had become the regent were many and varied. He had been one of five ruling council members in his country. The other four abdicated their positions or mysteriously lost the ability to live, just in time for Tanius to become regent. Seraph suspected the worst of him at all times.
"Don't patronize me," George snapped. "Nothing my spies have given us has been wrong so far. Fias is a dunce. If your spies knew what they were doing, I wouldn't have walked into a trap, your majesty," Fias ground out. "A trap? Bastian Leopold wasn't even at Forzel Valley."
"Enough," Tanius shouted, his voice crackling over the wireless. The silence lasted only a few moments.
"Fine. Have it your way, Tanius. But I'll tell you what I do know," George said, his voice laced with bitterness. "The Empire has invaded the Pearlescent Canyon again and restarted their war with Trafome. Fias didn't encounter a dozen champions because the Empire can't spare a dozen champions at our border."
George paused for a moment, and Seraph suspected he took a drink of water.
"They're battling the most powerful nation on Domar over the most important religious location to both nations. Omria herself descended there. Those fanatics in Trafome will throw everything they can at the Empire, and the Empire will hit back with everything they have. If we can't win now, what hope do we have?"
With those words, George disconnected from the wireless call. A high whine rose from the device, then quickly went away.
"Is that true?" Seraph asked. "Do we have confirmation that the Empire has finally started their war with Trafome?"
"That is not your concern," Tanius said.
The hell it wasn't, Seraph thought. If the Empire had already invaded Trafome, then that changed everything. Their entire country would gear up for war. Patriotism would skyrocket. Invading the Empire was insanity now. Any victory would be met by three new bastions a month later, eager to take back their homeland.
"Do you want my recommendation on what to do next, Regents?" she pushed.
She wasn't going to let Fias dictate the next steps with his peanut-sized brain.
"I don't think," Tanius began to say.
"Why?"
Fias spoke at the same time. Their voices overlapped, and the connection became a mess of static. A new voice cut through. Corvell said,
"You have had the most exposure to this new bastion, Seraph. Go ahead."
Tanius and Fias seethed silently. They couldn't openly contradict Corvell. Unlike George, who was considered a pompous fool, Corvell was wealthy and influential. In most nations, a smart man never angered a noble. In the Federation, people said the same thing about merchants. Money spoke the loudest here, and noble blood thinned with each passing year. Even Tanius trod lightly around Corvel.
"We can't mount another attack in time," Seraph said.
Fias interrupted. "You mean that you can't mount another attack in time? I am more than capable of it. Don't lump your incompetence on me." Seraph rolled her eyes and took a big gulp of wine.
"Of course, Master Fias, but even if you do attack, why would the results differ from your previous assault? That is my point. I can attack Garrick Pass tomorrow, but I will lose."
Knowing that Fias was about to interrupt her, Seraph spoke quickly.
"This new bastion, Nathan Straub, is far more capable than King George's spies gave credit for. He has defeated 2 Monogem champions, converted the bandit Spellblade we were grooming to become a champion, and may have even stopped the cascade from happening."
"I confirmed that the cascade took place," Fias growled.
"And then he showed up in Nair's tower the same day," Seraph said. "Given the first thing he did upon arriving at Garrick Pass was suppress our leyline disruption, it suggests that he has more advanced knowledge of the binding stones than we do."
"If you had attacked him yourself, then we wouldn't be in this mess," Fias said.
"Or maybe nothing would be different, except that I wouldn't be talking to you right now," Seraph said, losing her temper. "I am a duo-gem champion, but even I can't instantly suppress a demonic invasion and appear inside a sorcerer's tower miles away."
"But you," Fias shouted.
"Fias enough," Tanius said flatly.
Fias shut up.
"Seraph, give us your recommendation for the next move," Tanius said. "I believe we've heard enough of your reasoning."
His tone suggested that Seraph was treading on thin ice. He hadn't planned on the Empire winning any battles. Tanius's grand ambitions were unraveling, Seraph realized.
"Ask for peace," Seraph responded.
"Ridiculous," Fias snapped.
"Enough,"
Tanius thundered. The connection whined so loudly that Seraph thought he had cut her off.
"Seraph, explain yourself."
"I already did. We can't attack the Empire. If we do, we'll lose, like we already have. With every passing day, they'll regain their strength. If they can attack us and win, then they will."
Seraph felt that she wasn't getting through to them, so she pushed harder.
"They're focused on a different war. Our plans have failed. They'll let us back away without raising any fuss. Bastion Leopold is a political animal, but that also means he'll tear us apart if he gets the chance."
"Tear us apart how? You're overstating their strength," Tanius said dismissively. "It's precisely because the Empire is at war with Trafome that we don't need to sue for peace. They can't spare additional champions here. When the moment comes, we strike."
"If they have a dozen champions at Forzel Valley, they already have the strength," Seraph quipped.
"Don't press your luck," Tanius warned her.
Seraph's lips tightened into a line. Evidently, he knew that Fias was full of shit. Maybe Corvel had bought his excuse, but not anymore.
"I'm afraid that Tanius is right here," Corvel mumbled. "I agree that we cannot go on the offensive. But peace? Impossible. Too many guilds and trading companies have already factored in our victory. Their profit projections incorporate a Garrick Pass that does not charge tolls or tariffs, and they must be able to use the mines, forests, and farmland on the arable side of the mountains."
So that was it. The die had been cast before this meeting had been held. The profits of the Federation came before anything else. Or, more accurately, the profits of the wealthiest members of the Federation, who had captured the regencies of almost every state of the Federation.
"Honestly, Seraph, you're too concerned about this bastion," Tanya said. "You still have our trump card."
"She turned on us,"
Seraph responded flatly. I disagree. Tanius's tone allowed no dissent. Based on your report, the Bastion has her under his thumb. If she made her move to support us as initially planned, he would have taken her head in an instant.
Seraph remained silent. That wasn't the way she saw it, but she knew better than to argue right now.
A sigh crackled over the wireless before Tanius said, We're offering her what she's wanted for so long. The Empire has been denying her for years, denying her lineage for even longer. Unlike them, we honor our promises. Remind our precious contact in the Empire that our offer remains open. She merely needs to fulfill her end of the bargain and deliver us victory at the right moment.
As always, Tanius refused to identify who this contact was. Seraph followed suit, but wondered why that was the case. She knew her identity. Sunstorm had as well. Did Tanius distrust Corvell or George? Or maybe he thought that the knowledge would leak from Fias to one of his champions, and from them to the Empire. Probably the latter, Seraph thought. Tanius didn't become a regent by blindly trusting every idiot under his command.
Victory, High Lord? Seraph repeated, her tone questioning. Are you suggesting that we attack again?
As we should, Fias muttered. Fias, Tanius said, shutting the Bastion up.
Tanius paused, then answered,
No. You are right that being overly aggressive is the wrong choice. But peace is not an option. We will find an opportunity before winter.
By which he meant that Seraph would find an opportunity. She held her tongue again and remained silent as the meeting wrapped up. Seraph had been a champion long enough to see where this story ended. Unfortunately, her hands were tied, and she had already sent far too many of her younger brethren to their deaths. Poor Sunstorm, she thought, as she turned off the wireless communication device. Lilac had no real future as a champion, but Sunstorm's fate saddened Seraph. Given a good Bastion who cared, Sunstorm had the potential to be a duo gem champion. But Onyx gems were poorly understood on the mainland. The legacy of the Anfeng Empire meant that almost every champion used amethysts, diamonds, and rubies. Sapphires also proved popular due to the influence of non-human races. Those were considered honest, reliable gems on the mainland. Only on the Kurai Peninsula were rare gems such as onyxes used. Even when somebody understood what an onyx could do, it didn't help Sunstorm. A champion skilled in assassination was an asset to people like Tanius, but also terrifying. The idea of someone so stealthy and capable of undetected murder, but with the power of a duo gem champion? Seraph imagined that Tanius slept better now that Fias had told them that Sunstorm was dead. With a flash of her gem, Seraph vaporized her wine bottle. She scowled. Her fingers dug into the plush upholstery of her chair. For several seconds, she fought the urge to turn it into dust. But then she'd have to get a new one, and she was in the middle of nowhere. She sighed. Tomorrow was a new day, she supposed. She didn't know how many new days she had left in the Federation.
Chapter 33.
Color me impressed. I didn't expect you to stop both a demonic invasion and the Federation, Leopold said, perhaps a little too bluntly. He joined Nathan in a watchtower within the portal. The two of them stared out over the volcanic plains. No demons wandered here, and none had arrived since the invasion.
I'm not sure if I should be proud or appalled, Nathan drawled. Whatever the case, the portal is a heck of a lot larger.
Yes, that happens when you show off too much, Leopold said.
Nathan blinked. What did he say?
Haven't heard that before? It's a pet theory of mine, to explain the growth of portals.
Leopold grinned, and the edges of his lips vanished into his sideburns.
Portals open because the demonic energy is trying to escape. The faster we defeat the demons, the faster the energy is emitted. We know this. But what if we think of the energy like a river? What does a river do when it flows downhill?
It finds the path of least resistance, Nathan answered.
Leopold nodded. Exactly. That's what I think the portals are. The binding stones are confluence points of ley lines, which is why the demonic energy tries to escape here through a portal. When we suppress a portal, the portal grows, and the faster we suppress, the faster the growth. He rubbed his chin while frowning.
It's not a perfect explanation, and many events don't fit the logic, but it explains why portals grow faster in the presence of bastions and stronger champions.
And why your portal is growing rapidly compared to most.
Nathan had a separate theory, given what Kadria had told him. But he had to admit that Leopold's theory also made some sense. Kadria had implied that the messengers didn't pay much attention to their portals, and that Nathan's primary mistake had been to draw that attention to him. That meant that the portals had some automated means of growth. Was this whole thing some sort of game to the messengers? Nathan failed to wrap his head around what the messengers wanted. Kadria seemed oddly content to help Nathan, and even more content to spend time with him. Whatever her aim was, it seemed different to destroying this world. But he couldn't forget that she had done exactly that in his timeline. What changed her?
Deep thoughts, I take it? Leopold asked. Knowing that being better at my duty might make the Empire less safe doesn't make me feel better, Nathan half lied.
He told the truth that he didn't like the idea, but he had been thinking of something he couldn't tell Leopold.
True, that's why we keep our secrets and take our oath. The things that people may do if they knew how this worked are difficult to fathom, Leopold said.
His expression was stony.
Nathan wondered if Leopold had some idea of what those things were. The old man worked with people with the power to do very dangerous things, and who might not take kindly to the truth behind bastions and binding stones.
I can provide you with some good news, at least, Leopold said, clapping Nathan on the back. He descended from the watchtower as he spoke. After an invasion of this size, it usually takes a few months before they attack again, and if the portal is growing this much, maybe even a year.
Months, Nathan said flatly. Take what good news you can get, Leopold said.
His fake smile drifted back into place, but seemed strained.
To your office?
Kiana and Faye met them inside the keep. Faye's cheeks were bulging with food, and breadcrumbs ran down her chin and uniform. By contrast, Kiana was the model champion, with not a hair out of place. Not that Kiana was a champion yet. Faye blushed at the looks she received from Leopold and Nathan. She hurriedly brushed the crumbs away and swallowed her food. Her mumbled apology, flattened ears, and downturned tail earned her a visit from Nathan that night. Once Nathan and Leopold arrived at the office, the two girls trooped off to a neighboring room. Nathan made some coffee in the percolator while Leopold examined the map.
You're rather transparent, aren't you? Leopold said.
Am I?
You have markers in place along the entire border. Last I checked, you're only responsible for defending Garrick Pass.
Leopold's tone was dry.
And that map on the wall is one I am terribly familiar with.
He pointed at the smaller map hung on the wall, which covered the north of the Empire and its contested border with Trafoam.
I like to stay up to date, Nathan said.
Your coffee?
Thank you, Leopold said.
He stared at the map on the wall while he drank.
Do you know why we're fighting over the Pearlescent Canyon?
Do you want the official answer, the academic answer, or my opinion?
Nathan asked. He loudly slurped his coffee when Leopold looked at him sidelong.
You're much more confident this time, Leopold commented. I suppose you've earned the right. Last time we met, you had defeated some bandits and fought off a monogem champion. Now you've accomplished more than most bastions do in a decade, arguably their entire careers, given you've prevented a war.
Nathan paused at Leopold's comment. The war with the Federation had been prevented? That was Leopold's view on the matter? Had Nathan already accomplished what he had come back in time to do? He had been convinced that he had much more to do. Surely the Federation wouldn't give up after one failed assault, given they had gone to the extent of causing a demonic invasion. "I want your opinion, assuming it's accurate," Leopold said. "You'll quickly tell me if it's not," Nathan said. "No, I'll just think less of you." The older Bastion chuckled at Nathan's look. "I live and breathe politics. If I gave away my hard-earned knowledge for free, then I'd have been replaced long ago." Nathan nodded. If he were younger, he'd judge the old bastard harshly. Scratch that. He still judged him harshly, but that didn't make Leopold wrong. "The Pearlescent Canyon is where the Watcher Omria is believed to have descended to Domar millennia ago," Nathan explained. "It's a holy place. That's why the Order of Trafome will fight for it. They adore Omria and consider the canyon to be a sacred site." Leopold gestured for him to continue. Nathan continued. "But the Empire doesn't care about the religious importance. What matters is that the canyon is a reminder of the power of the Empire. When Omria walked Domar in the flesh, she backed the Anfang Empire and the Emperor. Every day that the canyon doesn't belong to the Empire is another day that it is reminded of its weakness." "So you think we're taking back the canyon purely as a show of strength to the rest of the world?" Leopold asked. His expression hadn't shifted. "I don't pretend to know why we're starting a war now, but I think we want to control the canyon because it's a symbol of the Empire's power, a legacy of the glory days." Leopold grimaced. "A fairly grim assessment of your homeland. Is it wrong?" "I did say I wouldn't correct you," Leopold said. He paused. "But I will say that your opinion would fit in well with those making realistic plans to help His Majesty. I can tell that you ran a county once, and also why your father didn't like you. He is a nationalist through and through." Leopold drained his coffee cup. It hit the table with a hard thud. Nathan frowned. "Something wrong?" he asked. "I gave you good news earlier," Leopold said. "I'm afraid there won't be much more to come." Nathan waited. He heard Faye's excited noises from next door and realized that his office wasn't soundproofed very well. "The Empire has begun its assault on Trafome," Leopold said. "That's behind schedule," Nathan commented. In reality, it was on time. Nathan knew that the Empire started the war around now. The difference was that he had already repelled the Federation. In his timeline, the Federation launched their attack within the next few weeks. "There was some hope that negotiations may allow us to claim ownership of the canyon, under strict terms with Trafome," Leopold said. "In practice, those negotiations bought time for the Empire to get as many bastions and champions in place. I was naive to believe we may escape a war." "So there are no reinforcements coming," Nathan said slowly. "No." "Why are you here then?" Nathan asked. "Because I am an old man who can do what he wants, and everybody is too scared to tell me what to do." Leopold laughed. "That, and His Majesty understands that we're being invaded by the Federation. It's in my hands to salvage the situation. But he needs a victory in the north, and I am his trusted right-hand man. I'll take out the trash trying to sneak in over the mountains." "I thought you told me that you didn't have any more good news," Nathan said. The pair chuckled. Leopold drummed his fingers on the table and stared at the markers. The arrival of food put their meeting on hold. Nathan stared at what the servant brought in. Bread, fried eggs, hunks of local ham, cheese, and onions. Nathan was very familiar with the sandwich, but it was the sort of thing one of his champions made him. Anybody could make it, especially with the fire-enchanted ovens and cooktops in a modern kitchen. Serving it to one of the most powerful men in the Empire seemed like a faux pas. Leopold picked up the sandwich and bit in. He let out a grunt of approval and took another bite. Yolk ran down his chin, and he wiped it away with a cloth that had been provided.
"This is a guilty pleasure of mine when traveling," Leopold admitted when they finished lunch. "In the capital or my fortresses, my chefs insist on serving me their fanciest and most impressive creations. But sometimes a man prefers simple."
"And loaded with meat," Nathan noted. "Faye would have been impressed by your sandwich."
"Don't lie. I read the reports. Her appetite is part of the reason she's a champion," Leopold said. "Beast can eat a lot, but no village can sustain a girl that practically eats a deer every day."
With lunch out of the way, they returned to the main subject. Leopold shuffled some markers around on the map. He held up one in particular.
"This is a Federation champion, isn't it?"
"It is. Sunstorm, the one that I first encountered with Sen," Nathan explained. He knew what was coming.
"Why is she now part of the Empire, according to these markers?" Leopold asked.
"I came to an agreement with her and transferred ownership of her gem to my binding stone." Nathan held his breath after explaining. Leopold stared at Nathan. Slowly, he placed the marker down.
"Well, I imagine that will terrify Fias," Leopold said.
"You know him?"
"I've heard of him before. My champions ran into him at Forzel Valley. A thug carved from marble and a face ripped right from a painting. He's stupid, very stupid. Normally I'd say that losing a champion would be enough, but I doubt he'll admit it to anyone."
Leopold sighed. He rubbed his eyes.
"He doesn't run the show," Nathan said. "A regent does."
"Your new recruit told you that, I take it?" Leopold grunted.
"I'm 99% certain that High Lord Tanius is behind this. He's a conniving bastard who stabbed his way to the top and helped build the Federation. I'd blame him for a lot of the problems in the world today, but that excuses the people that work with him."
Nathan scowled inwardly. He had been right. Tanius had been behind Seraph. In his timeline, Nathan had struggled with Tanius right up until the Federation collapsed under the weight of the man's arrogance. The man was the definition of vindictive. What he couldn't rule, he would see burned to ashes around him. In the end, Tanius didn't live to see it burn. Narime incinerated him first, but the damage had been done. Tanius brought down every nation west of the Garrick Mountains in Nathan's timeline. Arguably, he brought down every nation east of the Garrick Mountains as well, if he was behind the invasion of the Empire to begin with. Now Nathan had to deal with the bastard again. If he wasn't careful, the same thing could happen. There was no way that the war had been avoided. If Nathan let this end here, then Tanius would find a new way to bring about the end of the world. Leopold saw Nathan's face and let out a dark chuckle.
"I'm guessing Sunstorm shares my opinion, if that's your reaction. That bodes well. It makes me trust her that much more."
"You said that I prevented a war with the Federation," Nathan said, choosing his words carefully. "Can we really say that's the case?"
"Yes," Leopold answered, without hesitation.
Nathan grimaced.
"Hold your horses," Leopold said.
He shook his head.
"The fact is that we can walk away if we want. The Federation won't attack. Fias is terrified, and they won't have the resources. So we can sit on our hands until after winter if we like, which will keep His Majesty happy and the people unaware of the Federation's aggression. That's a possibility."
"And the other?" Nathan asked.
"The other is on your map."
Leopold inclined his head at the mess of markers on the map of the region.
"We use their attack as a casus belli. That's a justification for a war, if you don't know the fancy term, and invade the Federation. I don't know how much territory we take. I'd wager a couple of binding stones would be a nice start. Those always look nice.
and I have some political tactics up my sleeve to keep their neighbors out of it.
The ley line disruption, Nathan said bluntly.
You're sharp, Leopold admitted, his eyebrow shooting up.
Heresy isn't taken lightly by other bastions. The Dark Elves and Fairies won't intervene if they think the Federation is up to something.
Leopold smirked and said nothing.
Silence fell over the pair. Nathan felt that the choice lay with him, despite Leopold's earlier comment that the Emperor had tasked the old man to do this.
I have a plan to retake Vera's tower and to capture Fort Tobram, Nathan said. But I need your support.
You need a champion?
Leopold asked. At least one monogem champion. Preferably two, Nathan said.
Anything less, and I think the risk is too high. I'll lose champions and won't be able to defend what I capture.
Leopold nodded slowly.
Interesting. You realize that Fort Tobram's binding stone is warded, don't you? The sorcerers from the capital can undo the wards, but it will be weeks. You'll need to defend what you capture without a binding stone.
As I said, I have a plan. I only need your support, Nathan repeated.
Your confidence is fascinating, Leopold grinned. Very well, I will be your support.
Nathan blinked.
I'm sorry? I may not be a champion, but you know as well as I do that a bastion backed by binding stones can keep up with a monogem,
Leopold explained, his eyes glittering.
So I'll fight with you on the front lines. I'm looking forward to seeing you in action firsthand.
Somehow, Nathan felt that he might have made a mistake.
Chapter 34. Sparks flew as Fae and Sunstorm clashed. Neither broke through the other's guard, and they both leaped back. They circled. A crowd gathered in the training grounds. Soldiers and servants pressed themselves against the fence that separated the sparring ring from the rest of the training grounds. An enterprising young soldier began taking bets, and soon odds were set. Money exchanged hands. The two champions ignored the peanut gallery, but Kiana and Sen didn't. The pair sat on a bench inside the sparring ring, where the four women had been taking turns to train and spar all morning. Kiana glanced backward. Nathan waved at her, but ignored her look of concern. He doubted that it hurt for the women to be aware of their popularity in the fortress. The life of a champion meant becoming very well known to strangers, sometimes too well known. Nathan remembered a lot of occasions where his champions had clung close to him at parties, due to overbearing nobles. By contrast, the attention from the soldiers was innocent. They respected and adored the combat prowess of Fae and the other champions. If Kiana acclimatized to this attention, then it could only help her in the future. So Nathan continued to read through the paper he had in front of him. He made some notes in the margin as he went through it. Out of the corner of his eye, he continued to monitor the duel. Some time passed as Fae and Sunstorm fought to prove who was superior. Neither champion used their gem abilities. Strictly speaking, this put them on an even footing. In practice, it showed the raw gap in experience and skill between them. Both Fae and Sunstorm had the same enhancement. They were both monogem champions. Both were physical fighters. Sunstorm had a few years on Fae, however, and her background from Kurai went back into her teenage years, whereas Fae was a fresh champion. Fae swung. Sunstorm blocked. Fae fainted, but Sunstorm saw through it. Even when Fae pushed Sunstorm off balance or seized the advantage, she failed to follow through. Sunstorm's superior footwork or her experience in recovering from failure allowed her to stay in the fight. This current spar was desperate and heating up rapidly. Fae rained down blow after blow, pushing Sunstorm to the edge of the sparring circle. A combatant couldn't defend themselves outside of the circle, so a follow-up blow from Fae meant instant defeat for Sunstorm. Even so, the assassin continued to retreat. She held her ground right at the very edge.
the moment that Faye moved in for the kill, Sunstorm dropped both of her swords. As her arms twisted around Faye's sword arm, Faye let out a yell. The beastkin pulled back with all of her strength and rolled. Both women scrabbled with each other on the ground. Nathan sighed and went back to the paper, realizing he had let himself be distracted by the finale to the spar. Seconds later, Sen called out,
"Victory to Sunstorm! That's 4-1, so Sunstorm wins!"
The crowd groaned. The proceeds from the bets were doled out. Only a handful of people looked happy. Faye was a popular girl in the fortress. That was only natural, given she was the homegrown champion. Unfortunately for them, Faye still needed more experience. Her gem ability and raw talent made her an exceptional fighter, but her judgment tended to be lacking. Such as choosing to engage Sunstorm in a brawl when she had the advantage prior. Sunstorm was an expert in unarmed combat, and Faye wasn't. Reacting faster and pulling back would have been the best option, but failing that, Faye had daggers in her belt. Sunstorm would have had no choice but to let go the moment that Faye pulled out another weapon with her spare hand. Instead, she surrendered her best advantage, was dragged down into the dirt, and quite literally beaten. The four women milled about in the sparring ring, no doubt deciding what to do next. Their decision was made for them when the cooks brought out lunch. Boar was the dish of the day, and the wine and honey glaze dripped onto the serving platters.
"Is this going to be enough?" Sen asked.
Kiana gave her an odd look. "Isn't this almost an entire boar? I thought others were joining us." Moments later, Kiana's look changed to one of horror as Faye tried to stack her plate high enough to raise concerns about the integrity of the plate. "Faye, you can get seconds," Nathan chided.
"Fine," Faye mumbled, and returned some of the hunks of meat she had taken. "You get used to her," Sen said.
"Where does she put away all that meat?" Sunstorm asked.
"Her tits, I imagine," Sen muttered.
Sen, Sunstorm, and Kiana stared at Faye's impressive bust, then at their much less impressive chests. Their eyes immediately focused on Sunstorm, and Sen's eyes narrowed.
"You seem to be doing well enough," Sen said. "I thought they were smaller."
"I strapped them up in battle," Sunstorm admitted. "They get in the way otherwise, and I'm quite certain that their size is due to my parentage. My mother and sister were both larger."
"Lucky," Sen muttered. "If they get in the way, how do you deal with them, Faye? I can't even fit them in my hands."
Faye tried to answer, but her words came out as a garbled mess.
"Chew, then swallow," Sen told her.
Faye did as told, then said,
practice? I had to hunt daily for my food in my village. I ate too much, so they stopped giving me my allocated ration when I came of age."
"Practice doesn't make things that size move less." "I know," Sunstorm said, between bites.
"Beastkin physiques are different," Kiana answered quietly. "Because we move so much and are often nomadic, our bodies are much more adapted to physical movement."
Nathan listened in without saying a word. He found their conversation fascinating, mostly because he was certain they had forgotten that he was here. Normally, when he was around, one of them tried to get his attention, and that caused a fight. Usually Faye. He kept things from devolving too far by enforcing a strict rule about no sex outside the bedroom.
"So what, Faye grows bones beneath her tits?" Sen asked.
"I haven't," Faye objected.
"No, it's more that we have magic within our body that supports our bodies," Kiana said, shaking her head. "We look like humans, except for the tails and ears," Sen interrupted.
"And the rutting," Sunstorm added.
Kiana blushed.
"Let's not talk about that."
So, she was aware of that aspect of beastkin behavior. Faye showed no reaction, which suggested she was not. Nathan considered that unsurprising. Faye's upbringing didn't involve a good education, and he appeared to be the first man she had shown a serious interest in.
It might be another year before her beastkin physiology reared its head, although Nathan had ordered medicine to deal with it anyway. The last thing he needed was for Faye to be distracted in battle. She was Nathan's champion, not his pet.
Kiana cleared her throat and continued. We look like humans and largely act like them, but we have differences. The same that fairies and elves do. My stamina is far higher than a human's. Faye can likely run faster and is more dexterous. Wolves can bend steel with their bare hands. Compared to a champion enhancement, it's nothing, but it matters against ordinary humans.
And that makes it easier for Faye to fight with large breasts? Sen said,
her voice echoing her disbelief.
She won't have the physical discomfort or other issues that a human woman would, Kiana said. Then she paused. Plus, she's a champion. I think enhancements take care of that anyway. Given the speed she moves at, her bones would break without magical help. She's cutting through steel and running faster than draft horses.
Sen opened her mouth to argue, then closed it. She grimaced.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. I don't have an enhancement, so I forget how inhuman they are by default. The whole magic runs through their veins and makes them inhuman thing. Huh. No wonder the nights go on for so long.
Sen's eyes pierced Nathan's body. So they did know he was here. He ignored them and continued to eat his lunch while finishing the paper.
What's that you've got there, Nathan?
Sen asked, refusing his attempt to ignore her and continue eavesdropping.
An assessment for Kiana, Nathan said. Leopold asked me to handle her education while he's busy.
Busy, huh? Sen said.
She looked sidelong at Kiana, who avoided her gaze.
Isn't your bastion supposed to be helping us when we march through the pass soon?
Kiana remained silent.
I guess he must be really busy up north, huh?
Sen waggled her eyebrows and leaned in close to Kiana, who glared back at her.
He's visiting a couple of his champions and didn't want you getting in the way of his all-day sex romps?
Kiana pouted.
Probably.
Sen's face split into a grin, and she giggled.
Wow! Despite his age, he really is more like Nathan than I thought.
Kiana tried not to appear interested by the comparison. Her horse ears twitched, and her tail swished rapidly from side to side. She cleared her throat and looked innocently at Nathan.
Leopold said he only had time for the visit because Lady Von Clare wasn't ready. Is there anything in particular happening?
Anna is making some additional preparations with her troops, Nathan said, and I need to gather more power in the Binding Stone. It's still summer. We have time before the weather worsens in the pass and makes travel difficult.
What happens if this duo gem champion attacks us while he's away?
Sen asked, pointing her fork at Nathan as if to challenge him.
That would make things easier for us, he replied.
Sen scowled.
What if she attacks with a dozen champions?
Sunstorm opened her mouth to counter the idea, but Kiana spoke first.
That would be improbable, Kiana said.
Sen blinked and stared at the unicorn beastkin. Kiana held Sen's gaze without flinching or ducking her head. Continuing, Kiana said,
The engagement at Forzel Valley suggests that most of the Federation's champions are located there, which is reasonable given how much military strength the Empire has in the North right now. Furthermore, the Federation has significant commitments to the east. Its eastern border touches the Haukim Desert and is under constant attack by demons invading from the Kurai Peninsula. They also must—
I get it, Sen said. The Federation is a small nation with lots of neighbors, and all of their bastions and champions are already tied up. Everybody knows that. But what if they decide that it's worth the risk to take us out?
They won't, Sunstorm replied. If they were willing to take that risk, they wouldn't have sent expendable champions like Seraph and me. The table fell silent. Sen looked between Nathan and Sunstorm in search of help. This situation was far from her specialty.
Done, Nathan said, changing the topic. He handed back the paper to Kiana. I've made notes in the margins regarding some of what you wrote, but largely, there's not much to correct.
Are you sure?
Kiana asked, eyes wide. She held the papers against her chest. Yes. Your knowledge is well beyond what they teach at the academy. At this point, the only ways you'll learn are books, experience, and other bastions and champions, Nathan explained. He dug into a side of boar after pouring some relish over it. Faye tilted her head and swallowed.
If it's not taught in the academy, how come you can grade her assessment?
Sunstorm and Sen suppressed smirks, their eyes focusing on Nathan. Surely he couldn't worm out of this one. But Kiana shook her head.
Nathan has already proven that he used his time at the academy very wisely. I've learned a lot of what I know from books and questioning the academy's meisters when Leopold takes me there. There's a lot more for me to learn.
That's a smart approach to take, Nathan smiled, and Kiana ducked her head. Although you should start thinking about your path.
My path?
Whether you want to become a champion or a bastion, Nathan said. I can't speak for Leopold with regard to your aptitude, but I can say that you know a lot more than most champions ever learn.
Should we be offended? Sunstorm asked.
Nathan shrugged. There's no reason that I can't tell you more about the secrets of a bastion. You've taken a similar oath. He left out that Kiana hadn't, which could be a concern under normal circumstances. Most champions don't gain anything from knowing this sort of thing, and a lot don't have the aptitude.
All eyes subtly turned to Faye, then back to Nathan. So I should become a bastion, given the choice? Kiana said.
That's not what I'm saying.
Nathan paused and chose his words carefully.
Champions rarely make good bastions, but almost all bastions make good champions. But I don't know if anybody could be both a great bastion and a great champion, if they somehow had the ability to become both. I'm sure that one of these paths is right for you. Leopold has offered you a choice that very few get. I recommend that you make the most of it.
With those words, Nathan let the women return to their training. He had paperwork to fill out to prepare for the upcoming assault.
Chapter 35. A late-night invitation from Anna set Nathan's teeth on edge. Generally, being invited by a pretty noblewoman to meet her in a private parlor at close to midnight meant difficult times ahead. Nathan had no desire to be tied down to a noble, no matter their status or impressive looks. Not that he had ever thought about his future beyond being a bastion. Staring down the end of the world left little time to worry about retirement, and things had only become more complicated since coming to this timeline. His worries for the future limited themselves to the next few months or years at most. Nathan walked through the halls of the keep to the meeting place. More soldiers patrolled the corridors than usual, and the lamps kept everything well lit. The fortress bustled with activity. Outside, supply trains ran along the highways from Forzell Valley and elsewhere in the county. A young beastkin girl stood guard outside the parlor. Unlike the other soldiers, her uniform lacked Anna's emblem. She worked only for Nathan and was one of his recent hires. At the sight of Nathan, the guard snapped off a salute. Her wolf ears twitched, and her tail wagged faster and faster with each step Nathan took toward her. But she stared resolutely forward. Nathan saluted back as he entered the parlor, and the beastkin froze for a moment. He caught her ears shooting bolt upright out of the corner of his eye before the door closed.
"Enjoying your new personal guard?" Kuda said, catching Nathan's attention.
The lights were on, and Kuda was in the room with Anna. Nathan took those as good signs for this meeting. He accepted the coffee that Kuda offered him and took a seat. Anna sat opposite him and seemed distracted by her thoughts. She idly sipped at her coffee. A handful of papers lay in front of her.
"I wouldn't say enjoying, but I do like having soldiers of my own," Nathan said. "And the fact that they're all beastkin?"
Kuda probed. His lips turned upward at the edges.
There are a lot of beastkin villages nearby. Wolves near the mountains, cats down by the sea and along the rivers, horses in the plains. I have a lot of ways to make money as a bastion, and not many ways to use it, Nathan explained. By contrast, the villages out here don't have much. The county that Faye grew up in has denser forest than Garrick. Kuda inclined his head in understanding, and his smile vanished.
True. Very true. A rising tide lifts all boats, but it requires the tide to reach those boats to begin with. The beastkin live a harsh life, even though the Empire has banned slavery. Simple solutions only get us so far.
Nathan frowned. Politics. He was never very good at it. The same went for economics. Logistics, warfare, magical theory, leadership, even some elements of nation-building, such as the mechanisms of bureaucracy, how merchants made money, and taxes. These were the things that Nathan specialized in. But applying those to a political or economic framework never sat well with him. He could make the leap if he wanted to. He knew what Kuda meant. The Empire was wealthy, and the nobles especially so. Nathan was extending a helping hand, but Kuda was indirectly questioning if it was enough. He questioned if the Emperor cared about the beastkin at all, given how little was done to help them. On the other hand, Nathan didn't run an empire responsible for protecting, feeding, managing, clothing, and housing countless millions. He didn't have to keep unruly nobles in line, who might have aspirations to do worse. He also had no way to reconcile such ideas with the existence of the Academy, and the fact that the Empire had already done more to help the Beastkin than most of Domar. Every other country besides Falmir and the Empire allowed slavery, or a close equivalent. In the end, Nathan shrugged off Kuda's attempt to politicize the discussion.
Maybe, maybe not. I'm a bastion, not a noble or a ruler. I could say the same about Bastion Leopold, Kuda countered.
Nathan frowned. This isn't really a discussion I specialize in, Kuda. War is black and white. Stopping demons is black and white. Or it was, before Nathan met Kadria, but he ignored her existence for now.
But political change?
Anna spoke up. If you didn't care, why are you explicitly helping the Beastkin?
Because they make excellent soldiers and guards, Nathan said. Wolf Beastkin especially are exceptionally strong. If I want to build a unit of knights capable of stopping demons, instead of firing catapults from behind walls, then my best starting point is Beastkin.
Ah, so it's not pity after all, Kuda said. My mistake.
Nathan shrugged and drained his cup.
I do feel that part of my duty as Bastion is to share some of my largesse. The Binding Stone lets me create trade goods from nothing, so I'm not hurting for money. There's a term from Trafome about how nobles need to share some of their birthright, because they didn't earn it.
Noblesse oblige, Anna supplied. More specifically, it's about how nobles must act nobly, and part of that means to extend our wealth and power to those who do not have it. Saying that it's a controversial topic among nobles is an understatement, although I imagine you're about to spark a lot of interest in it.
I am? Nathan asked.
He blinked. The door opened and Leopold stepped in. Nathan caught the Beastkin guard gawking at the older bastion and gestured for her to calm down. She blushed and resumed her stoic posture. No wonder Kuda had commented on her when Nathan walked in. She only hid her reaction when she thought somebody was looking.
Am I interrupting something?
Leopold asked. He eased into a seat with a wince.
My apologies. I had a long ride here.
Nathan looked at Anna in disbelief.
You invited him to a midnight meeting on the same day he arrived?
The two of you are going to be busy tomorrow. How else am I going to butt in?
She muttered. Her hands smoothed out her dress, which Nathan belatedly noted was frillier than usual.
We were discussing the idea of noblesse oblige and how the war will cause renewed debate over it.
Ah, yes, the ethical debate over hereditary nobility.
Leopold sighed.
Well, at least I'm sitting down.
Really? That relates to this war? Nathan asked.
to us, this war is about border tariffs, demons, and a power-hungry regent seeking to gain more influence within the Federation, Leopold explained. But how do we justify the war to the people of the Empire? I hate to say it, but the reality is that it will be through the difference between our nations. We may be changing slowly, but we live in a country of nobility. The Federation is different.
Anna interjected. Is the Federation really that different to us? All of the regents are people who held power in their former nations. They're nobles by any other name.
Perhaps, but that's not how they see it. And when they die, their sons and daughters are not guaranteed to become regents. Whereas your children will inherit Garrick County, Leopold said.
Anna bit her lip, but said nothing more.
More politics, Nathan thought. But this time, he understood it, because it influenced the way he could fight this war, and the way the countries would react to it.
Nathan licked his lips. This seems like the sort of thing that could spiral out of control quickly.
Ha, yes, Leopold said. Hence why His Majesty has left me in charge. Ideally, I intend to make this war about the countries as little as possible. Hence the heresy charge. The more we can pin this on individuals at the top of the Federation, the less this becomes about entire systems of governance. Nobody wants a total war between nations. The instability would threaten the entire world.
Yes, yes it would, Nathan thought.
He leaned back in his chair in relief. He didn't want to deal with this political mess. Maybe one day it would rear its ugly head, but today he fought a simpler war. One about stopping a federation that had attempted to use demons to attack the Empire, and had committed heresy against Omria while doing so.
Well, it's late. I assume you called us together for a reason, Anna, Leopold asked.
He thanked Kuda for the cup of dark coffee, then held it high in the air. As he had been practiced many times, Kuda poured a shot of brandy into the coffee. Nathan and Anna pretended not to notice. On the one hand, the Elder Bastion's late-night drinking habits were his own business, even if they might raise an eyebrow given his age. On the other hand, worries over poisoning attempts meant that nobody was going to try to pour something into Leopold's drink out of his sight. Nathan didn't need much of an imagination to picture how most of his new Beastkin guards would react if they saw Kuda, or any other servant, slipping something extra into Leopold's drink. Blood would flow, and a promising new recruit would end their career in a traumatizing way.
"You're marching on Vera's tower soon. I want in on the planning," Anna said.
She uncrossed her legs and leaned forward, eyes flashing with excitement. Leopold and Nathan exchanged glances. Neither had expected this.
"Don't look at each other like that. I'm the Countess. It's my armies that will support you," Anna said, her voice imperious. Her lip quivered.
Leopold held a hand up and sipped his coffee using his other. Silence fell, and Anna took the chance to regain her composure. A subtle lean of Leopold's head indicated to Nathan that he needed to take the lead here. He caught the cue, then cleared his throat. Anna turned to him, her lips halfway toward a pout.
"I'm still the bastion assigned to your county, Anna," Nathan said, trying to mollify her. "If you want to be involved, you can be involved."
"That's not what I mean," Anna muttered. "I said it before, didn't I? I want to be the Countess that supports you. My family has protected these lands for generations. I won't be the one who fails to achieve greatness when it's within grasp."
"Quite greedy, aren't you?" Leopold said, his voice laced with amusement.
Anna shot him a cutting look, and he winked back at her.
"I finally gave you the bastion you've been asking for after all of these years, and now you also want to claim his glory?"
"That's not—"
Anna stopped talking and scowled at Leopold. Nathan blinked and looked between the pair in confusion.
"Years?"
"Yes, years."
Anna rolled her eyes.
I told you when we first met that I wanted somebody to help remind the Empire that this county exists, didn't I? To the south is land held directly by the Archduke, and it is mostly occupied by Beastkin. North is better, but it's strategically important. Other than the old man here, I don't get my day in court.
You have a vote in the Diet, Leopold pointed out.
A vote?
Anna crossed her arms.
None of the councils, committees, or even working groups that my father sat on bothered to extend an invitation to me when he passed.
Nathan coughed, and both Anna and Leopold turned to him.
I'm sorry, Nathan said, not feeling sorry at all. But Anna, you told me that you asked for a bastion only a year ago.
Anna stared at Nathan, then she glared at Leopold.
You didn't tell him?
Leopold drained his cup and placed it on the table. He placed his hand over it to indicate to Kuda not to refill it. His eyes focused on Nathan, and he refused to look at Anna.
I didn't feel it pertinent, Leopold said. I was unaware you only told him when you asked for an Imperial Bastion, rather than when you requested that the Academy accept a specific person to become a Bastion.
I'm not sure I follow, Nathan said slowly. The room felt colder somehow. Leopold still refused to look at Anna, despite her angry and confused expression.
You're... never mind, Anna muttered, and stopped glaring at Leopold. Fine, I'll explain it.
Anna shook her head and faced Nathan.
Before I formally requested a bastion from the Imperial Army, I spent years helping somebody else to enter the Academy. She had been interested almost her entire life, but only when my father fell ill did I gain the ability to sponsor her.
Because you gained the power of your household, Nathan said. You weren't the Countess yet, but as the heir, you may as well have been.
Anna nodded. Exactly. Unfortunately, she was never successful, despite multiple sponsors.
Anna glanced at Leopold, who refused to look back at her.
By the time my father passed away, and I took over full control of the household and county, it was something of a lost cause.
Until you eventually needed military support because your brother left?
Nathan asked, trying to keep the skepticism out of his voice.
I prompted her earlier than that, Leopold said, his poker face smile back in place.
You did, yes,
Anna said, after a long pause. She didn't elaborate on why. Nathan sighed.
That someone. Who was it?
He had a strong feeling he already knew. There was only one person he had met with a strong enough interest in bastions and champions, to say nothing of her bitterness toward Leopold, to have applied multiple times to enter the Academy.
Vera, Anna answered.
Chapter 36.
Seraph's not here, Sunstorm reported. Not yet, anyway.
Nathan nodded and let her take up a position behind him. Below him, Anna's army formed ranks and prepared for battle. They had marched through the pass today, and Vera's tower wasn't far. Federation banners fluttered around the base of the tower. Nathan watched from atop the bluffs above the pass. Leopold, Anna, Vera, and his champions accompanied him. Kiana remained behind. Leopold refused to risk her in a battle that might involve a duo-gem champion. She had attempted to convince Nathan and appeal to him in various ways. He had politely declined. Several times. One time, Faye had declined on his behalf and thrown a half-naked unicorn beastkin out of Nathan's bedroom. She had not appreciated Kiana horning in on her territory. On the other hand, Kiana's straightforward seduction attempt made it very clear that she was interested in Nathan. A small part of his mind had worried that she might be more interested in her mentor, but that idea could happily be put to bed. Curiously, Kuda accompanied Anna. Given neither had any intentions of participating in the battle itself, Nathan doubted he planned to fight, but he carried a sword and wore light armor nonetheless. Anna's army was larger than Nathan expected. He had kept a decent defensive force at the keep and left his new recruits behind. Despite this, Anna mustered a significant army, if a smaller one than the Federation defended the tower with. She had levied soldiers from all across her county. With Leopold's authority, and more importantly, his money, she had even levied soldiers from the Beastkin villages to the south. Very little of the army was professional, and most of it had never fought before, but numbers helped. The Beastkin's raw power and skill in hunting lent a quality all its own. Nathan had stepped in and helped organize the army, however. Anna and her officers lacked any experience in command and had never managed a mixed army like this. Even things as basic as which Beastkin played well together were new to them. A smart man did not put Wolf Beastkin in the same company as any other Beastkin. For one thing, the wolves were unlikely to talk to anybody other than their own kin. Second, most other Beastkin became really jittery around large numbers of wolves. Even Faye acted a bit funny when the wolves in the keep gathered in groups of more than three or four. Given the Federation forces outnumbered his, Nathan organized his offensive to handle it. Ideally, he could rely on his champions to limit casualties. Faye and Sen possessed extremely powerful abilities that fell into the category of anti-army. The downside was that both were so fantastically powerful that Nathan hesitated to use them too much. Faye's flames melted flesh and metal and guaranteed a painful death for anybody she targeted with them. Sen's spells were less terrifying to witness, but only if she restricted herself to third-rank spells. Even with fourth-rank spells, Sen reduced entire columns of men and women to ash. Ultimately, the Federation soldiers were merely men and women who fought for their nation. They had families. Most probably didn't even know why they were fighting the Empire. Turning countless hundreds of comparatively innocent people into ash didn't sit well with Nathan. He had done that far too many times in his timeline. Entire battlefields filled with corpses lined his memories as far back as he cared to remember. If he could avoid doing that here, and instead force the Federation to flee, then Nathan would take the chance. The cost was the lives of the soldiers under him. That didn't sit well with him either. War was shit, Nathan thought. It reminded him of why he wanted